Thanks a lot for having me here. This is my first ever CAPRA meeting and I'm enjoying it so far. So I'm going to be talking about the hidden symmetry behind this vanishing Love numbers for black holes. So this talk is going to be based on a work done in collaboration with Panos Charlambos and Sergei Dubovsky. So let me start by saying that, well, as Hornchan just explained, Love numbers are one of the key parameters that determine our gravitational waveforms. And also, you know, they allow us to probe the internal structure of compact objects. And hence, they will be super useful if we want to probe gravity and maybe potentially to discover some beyond the standard model effects and objects. So if this happens, it's going to it will happen like this, that we detect some gravitational wave signal, we fit it, we find some optimal parameters. Imagine that the compact objects will have masses greater than a few solar masses, and Love numbers are zero, then we're dealing with black holes. But if Love numbers are not zero, then we're dealing with something else, which is not, which doesn't live in jar, which is a clear smoking gun of beyond the standard model physics. And I think that that's why Love numbers are crucial targets if we are to detect new physics. Now, I guess from this discussion, it's clear that in order to do such a discovery, we need to have some very precise tools to compute waveforms. And one of such tools is the effective field theory of inspiring binaries. So in this effective field theory, well, essentially the source in this EFT framework, the all source properties, no matter how complicated source it is on the inside, like it's say long range properties are fully captured by the long wavelength degrees of freedom, such as the center of mass position, center of mass coordinate, then the long wavelength gravitational field, long wavelength electromagnetic field, and potentially like a scalar field, like a fifth force. So we're not aware of this in real nature, but let's consider this as a possibility. So in this case, the all you know properties of our almost all properties of our sources on large scales, they're parameterized, they can be captured by this word line effective action. So for a scalar field, you'd have, you know, the coupling of the word line and this tidal scalar tensor. Then for the electromagnetic part, you will have something like derivatives of the electric field, the same for magnetic. And for the gravitational part, you will have something like a square of the electric Riemann tensor and the same contribution for the magnetic part. And here you can see the appearance of these coefficients, C0, C1, and C2. So those are Wilson coefficients of the effective field theory. And in fact, they can be interpreted as the EFT Love numbers. And in fact, using this effective action, now we can do a tidal response calculation. We can set up some external source and compute how it interacts with our word line through this coupling. And we can do this simple three-level diagram calculation. For instance, in the gravitational case, we can compute, let's say, the wild scalar in the L equals two sector. So we're gonna find the contribution, which is given by the source, and then the correction, which is produced by this effective operator C2. So it's gonna be C2 over R to the fifth power in the quadrupolar case. And this exactly corresponds to the usual Newtonian tidal response calculation. All right, so now these coefficients, how do we match them? How do we determine their values? We match our EFT calculations to some microscopic UV calculations. So for black holes, we match EFT to the results of black hole perturbation theory. And here I would like maybe to stress that in principle, EFT gives a well-defined, like a robust and gauge invariant definition of Love number. So we can rewrite these effective operators in a manifestly covariant form. For instance, for a scalar field, this would look like this. So we introduce this projector operator, and we can do the same thing for other spins. And in principle, this is just, you know, this shows that there is a well-defined and robust definition of Love numbers, which is given by the EFT itself, and it's perfectly gauge invariant. It agrees with the textbook definition in the Newtonian limit. All right, so let's discuss this matching. So for black holes, we can explicitly match this EFT to the black hole perturbation theory results. And we're gonna find out that in four dimensions, all Love numbers are zero for black holes. So for scalar field, electromagnetic field, and gravitational field, they're all zero. And this, from the EFT point of view, represents some fine-tuning problem, some nationals paradox, which becomes more intricate when we go into higher dimensions, where generic Clough numbers do not vanish, but then there are other kinds of fine-tuning. Some of Clough numbers, they run a certain number of dimensions, some of them do not run, sometimes they still become zero, and so on and so forth. So it's all suggesting that we're missing certain selection rules in our EFT. And so in my talk, I'm going to show exactly what are the rules that we're missing. I should say that sometimes, like during talks, I hear that people try to link it with the no-hair theorem, but to me, it seems that these two things are not related, or at least there is no direct relationship between the two. And the clear-cut argument is like, let's take a look at higher dimensions where the appropriate, you know, no-hair theorems are all true, but Clough numbers are not zero. So I think that there is no direct link between the two. All right. So the story that I've been discussing so far was about Schwarzschild black holes. Now, in the case of Kerr black holes, we have less symmetry, so we don't have the full rotational symmetry. And in that case, we need to generalize our EFT. So we need to promote the Clough numbers to, in fact, the Clough tensors, certain Wilson Clough tensors, which look like this, some lambda ijkl. And you can write similar, you know, tensors for higher order multiples. So they will have more indices. And here, you know, by construction, this tensors, they're symmetric, and they capture only the conservative tidal deformation, the conservative effects. And well, you can clearly see that like this tensor cannot be anti-symmetric, the word line coupling will just vanish. And this situation corresponds to dissipative response contribution. So in fact, EFT also allows you to clearly distinguish between the two. And also here we can do the full, you know, EFT calculation and match it to the results of the black hole perturbation theory calculation using the Tikhovsky equation, and find out that for the Kerr case, also all the Clough tensors are zero. So the Kerr black holes tidal deformability is zero, well, conservative effect. And the same is true, you know, for the electric field and for scalar field. So the black holes, the Kerr black holes are pretty boring objects in this sense, because they only, you know, absorb stuff and maybe reflect, but they never get deformed and they never react to an electric field or to a scalar field, but only in four dimensions somehow. All right, so what's going on? Why this happens? Why this natural paradox takes place for black holes and for Z? To understand this, let's consider the notion of near zone. So let me focus on the scalar field example, but essentially the argument will be the same for a generic spin S by virtue of the Tikhovsky equation, which has the same essentially complexity for all possible spins. So we know that, okay, the scalar field equation factorizes in the Kerr background, and its radial part satisfies, well, the following equation. It has a certain effective potential, and this potential can be split into two pieces. One piece becomes important around the black hole, the other piece becomes important far away. So let me focus only on the piece around the black hole. So let me ignore this V1. Then also I should mention that there are two relevant parameters that appear here. This is the angular velocity of a black hole horizon. And the second parameter is the Hawking temperature, which here I call beta. So it turns out that in this near zone approximation, there is a hidden symmetry, which we call Clough symmetry. So we can write down the following vector fields, L naught, L1, and L, so L plus and L minus. So they look a lot like Killing vectors, and in some sense they are. So they satisfy the SL to R commutation relations. And if you compute their Casimir, the Casimir is going to be given exactly by the differential operator of the Tikhovsky equation in the near zone approximation. And from this, it follows a very important property that, in fact, the near zone black hole perturbations, they form representations of SL to R. And this, you know, helps us now to understand all physics just from the representation theory of SL to R, you know, without ever needing to deal with differential equations. So let's discuss these representations. For SL to R, they're fully characterized by two numbers, by the Casimir and by the minimal eigenvalue of the operator L naught. Let me call it magnetic number. So the minimum value of M. So in our, you know, physically relevant near zone case, L is integer and the minimal value of M is zero for static solutions, right? Because M is proportional to L naught. L naught is dt. So if dt is zero, it means that we have a static solution. So for simplicity, okay, let me now focus on L equals two and like build explicitly a highest weight representation, because for this particular L and M, we have a highest weight representation. So its construction goes like this. We start with a primary vector. It satisfies the following equation. So it's annihilated by L plus. And then we take this primary and act on it with lowering operators, and we form the whole multiplet. In the Schwarzschild case, the multiplet is finite dimensional, so it truncates at m equals two for the quadrupolar case. In the Kerr case, it's infinite dimensional, and we form the so-called Verman module. But here it's important that we have this m equals zero state, so which corresponds to a static solution, so dt equals zero. And this state is part of the highest weight representation. And this implies that this state is annihilated by three Riesen operators. So then if I just take this L plus cubed V2 equals zero and use my expression for Killing vector for the generators, I'm gonna find that it's proportional to the radial derivative to the third power, from which it immediately follows that V2 is a finite polynomial, like the static solution is a finite polynomial in R. It doesn't have any decaying powers, and hence Lof numbers are zero.
2 minutes.
Thank you. All right, so essentially the same argument goes for any multipolar index and for any spin. And I should also say that Lof symmetry explains phenomenology of Lof numbers in higher dimensions, because there are generalizations of the symmetry there. So please ask me questions how it actually goes, but it really explains all the fine apparent fine tunings from the representation theory of SL to R. Now, what is the spectrum? What is the multiplet that we have generated with the Lof symmetry? So first we have these primary states, which are exponentially growing solutions. So they correspond to us unstable modes. So essentially they represent a physical situation where we pump up energy into a black hole. Well, typically we're not interested in those, and those are killed by boundary conditions at infinity. Then we have the static solution, which is a finite polynomial. And then we have a whole bunch, well, in principle, an infinite tower of quasi-normal modes, which are really highly damped quasi-normal modes, and they have the correct spacing of imaginary frequencies. All right, so are we done now? On the one hand, it seems yes, because the Lof symmetry indeed corresponds to like an enhanced symmetry point, and it's consistent with the Hooft naturalness dogma. On the other hand, the Lof symmetry has an unusual property that mixes IR and UV modes, which is not common in the QFT. And I guess that the third interesting question is, what is the reason for this symmetry to exist in the first place? And I think that it must be related to the presence of the horizon, and some insight can be obtained from studying the extremal limit. So as you know, in the extremal limit, the black holes, they have enhanced symmetry. So they have an infinitely, like the near horizon region has an infinitely long throat, whose symmetry is ADS2, and its isometry group is exactly SL to R. So it can be shown that in the Reiström-Nordström case, our Lof symmetry exactly reduces to the near horizon isometry of ADS2. And in the Kerr case, the situation is more interesting, because there is a bigger symmetry, which contains both Lof symmetry and the near horizon symmetry as different subgroups, so in full symmetry as a SL to R semi-cross U1. And this gives an interpretation of the Lof symmetry that in fact, it's a realization of the spontaneously broken near horizon isometry. All right, so let me summarize. So the Lof symmetry resolves the naturalness paradox in the word line effective field theory and explains all known facts about Lof numbers, including higher dimensions, and also it predicts new relations, for instance, between the quasi-normal modes and responses. And it has a well-defined geometric, well, it has a sound geometric interpretation and some intricate relationship with the extremal near horizon isometries. So thank you.
Thank you. Leo?
Hi, Mikhail, nice talk, but I probably missed something or just don't understand. Are these approximate Killing vector fields in some scaling limit?
Exactly, these Lof symmetry, indeed, those are approximate Killing vectors of the Kerr spacetime.
Okay, and what is the scaling symmetry that you have to take to see the you know, the satisfaction of the approximate killing vector equation?
Well, it's the distance to the horizon, roughly.
Okay, is that in your recent paper?
This near horizon interpretation is not yet dead, but we're going to publish a paper soon about this. Okay.
Because I mean, I remember seeing these things about like approximate symmetries of a differential equation, but not from an actual isometry point of view. And I mean, I still don't understand how, like, if you do a small omega expansion, how is that supposed to have a real space isometry interpretation?
Well, this is, we're still trying to better understand this, but I should say that here the like real expansion parameter is not the smallness of frequency itself, it's the like really this near zone expansion. So around the, in the vicinity of the horizon, it's the near zone approximation is valid for all frequencies. So really there is a different parameter which controls, I think that formally the near zone expansion is controlled by this parameter. So it's like distance to the horizon times the frequency. Of course, like far away, it's like this, when this is big, you need frequency to be small, but around the horizon, it's that way around. Well, in principle, you can have large frequencies in some sense.